crowd loud. Fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want. We want. We want. We want. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. This week, we swing into the new year, 2025, with media scholar Nolan Higdon. We'll discuss the incoming administration, Trump 2.0, what that means for freedom of the press, social media, and an end to so-called fact-checking, and why we will continue to need a truly independent press to keep us informed moving forward. Later in the program, another media scholar, Steve Masick, joins the program. It's deja vu all over again as we revisit previously censored news stories around significant current events and how the ongoing lack of establishment media coverage around key issues contributes to low information voters and allows myriad injustices to persist at home and around the globe. Stay tuned for a brand new Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio coming up next. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today in this segment, we kick off the new year by welcoming back media scholar Nolan Higdon. He's an author, lecturer at Merrill College in the Education Department at University of California, Santa Cruz. He is a Project Censored national judge and commentator, as well as a founding member of the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas. Higdon's areas of concentration include critical AI literacy, podcasting, digital culture, news media history and propaganda, and critical media literacy. His work's available at Substack, nolanhigdon.substack.com. He is the author and co-author of numerous books, including The Anatomy of Fake News, Let's Agree to Disagree, The Media and Me, Surveillance Education, United States of Distraction, and others. He is a regular source of expertise for CBS, NBC, The New York Times, and the San Francisco Chronicle, and of course has worked with us at Project Censored for a number of years, and also is a contributor of The Edge at the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. Nolan Higdon, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Happy New Year, Mickey, and Happy New Year to the Project Censored universe. Appreciate being here.
It's always good to catch up with you, and I know that we're going to have a busy year writing, commenting, critiquing the things that are happening. Certainly, we're now looking at the incoming Trump 2.0 administration. Naturally, it was quite an interesting election in many ways. We see that the rank-and-file Democrats have yet to learn lessons from the past several decades regarding the outcome of that election. But let's talk a little more specifically about media, social media, and the interesting trend of many elites in media and in big tech, Silicon Valley, really kind of coattailing and lining up to sort of kiss the ring of a Trump 2.0, whether fawning over him at Mar-a-Lago or in the press. We see outlets censoring information. We see social media outlets now moving away from fact-checking, which you and I have been critical of, but we're going to talk about that today too. But let's just start with the Trump-Musk love affair with Silicon Valley and some of the bizarre things that are happening in the GOP and in the media ecosystem in general. Nolan Higdon.
Remember when all these people in media and the political class were circling the wagons, calling Trump real-life Hitler and saying he's this fascist. And then all of a sudden in 2025, these people are lining up behind him one after another, whether it be the Jeff Bezos type or Tim Cook from Apple, or now Zuckerberg seems to have bent the knee to him. Earlier, of course, we had the Morning Joe, MSNBC people. This is what the consolidation of power looks like here. Trump won. He had a pretty impressive victory. I mean, let's not forget 4 years ago, we were all writing obituary for this guy for January 6th and those kinds of things. Now he came back with this victory. He's got economic power, political power. He's got the media behind him. It's been quite a transition to see. But in addition to all that, I think it really reveals just the lack of principles that so many of these folks actually have. Zuckerberg at one point thought Trump was so dangerous he had to remove him from his platform. And now Zuckerberg is changing everything about his platforms just to appease Trump and make Trump feel comfortable on it, including moving part of his business to Texas, getting rid of the fact-checking that right-wingers have been critical of, adding Dana White from UFC, a major Trump supporter, to the Meta board. And so I think it's just revealed that these people always said what they thought would get them the right audience and right attention. They actually had no principles or commitment to it. I can't think of any example in history where someone went from concluding someone was Hitler, like the Morning Joe cast did, to turning around and saying, we need to build a bridge and talk with these people. I mean, it was just really an astounding display of the lack of backbone and principles by these people.
Well, what's also fascinating is we've seen, as you and I have talked about, Team Red and Team Blue media outlets, corporate media outlets that preach to a particular ideological audience to guarantee certain ratings. What we saw just in the last basically 2 months is really a collapse of MSNBC as a news model. Can you talk a little bit about that and what's happening in some of the neoliberal media sphere? What even passes for quasi-liberal corporate media, as it were?
I did a lot of analysis of this because I thought it was one of the most interesting aspects of the election, and it's gotten very little coverage. In a nutshell, when liberal or Democratic Party voters came out of the election, I think they realized they've been bamboozled for years at this point by the very media system. They were told Kamala Harris was going to win, you know, it was me neck and neck, and it wasn't close at all. She got stomped in these so-called swing states. Prior to that, you know, they were told Joe Biden is going to win. He beat him once. He's going to do it again. He's got the soul of America. Sure, he looks tired on screen, but you should see him behind the screen. He's running circles around everyone. That totally flopped with the debates, or I guess lack of debate that took place in June. So I just think time and time again, these audiences have realized that they don't have a grip on what's going on around this country if they watch Democratic or neoliberal media. And this includes things about like working class or even some communities of color or some women, particularly white women. They were told, you know, they would never vote for Trump. That Puerto Rico joke was going to kill the Latinx votes for Trump. And he actually gained ground in all of these areas. It was just, I think, a undeniable display to liberal viewers that the media they're consuming is completely propagandizing them about electoral politics. And so now we've seen these huge declines in audiences. Like some primetime shows on MSNBC have lost 61% of their value. Rumor has it Rachel Maddow is taking a ginormous pay cut. We saw Chris Wallace at CNN step down after he had gotten that lucrative contract just a handful of years ago. The folks remember that. He stepped down as CNN seems to be cleaning house over there. So I think this is an exciting time for independent media. I will say that about this time period. A lot of the problematic legacy media is losing its audiences. But as we all know, as media scholars, that audience isn't going to necessarily be captured by the most trustworthy sources. There are a lot of other pernicious propaganda sources in new media that are certainly going to try and track that audience.
You mentioned party leadership in the Democratic Party being oblivious to many of these things, or willfully ignorant, at least. It's as if they didn't notice the Bernie Sanders campaign of 2016 at all. And they forgot entirely, apparently, that Harris didn't win any primaries. This time around, they didn't even really bother to have a primary, which leads me to something else you said. And we've talked about this before. And in fact, Project Censored, you and I, and others, a year or more prior to the election. That the idea that Biden was running without anybody taking stock of what anybody could witness, that there was definitely something going on, and it seemed as though the administration was definitely handling him. Turns out that we were right factually. We've now discovered matter-of-factly that there was a concerted effort in his administration to basically conceal anything happening with him from the public, to not have him interact with media. I mean, we're talking more than George W. Bush levels in the first year he was in office when he was on vacation 40% of the time and gave fewer press conferences than any president in history. You know, Biden in many ways went on eclipsing that, and it's as if we weren't supposed to notice that it was kind of an AWOL situation. And then now, once we get into the election and the election is over, now there's this hand-wringing saying, like, well, why didn't we know, or who didn't know, or what was going on? It's another example, seemingly, of both willful ignorance and efforts to censor or conceal vital information from the public that I believe obviously has backfired in this case in terms of how the Democrats ran the primary.
I completely agree, but I think it even is worse than that as more of these details start to emerge. Now, you're absolutely right. It's become very clear that most people who had contact with Biden thought he was not cognitively able to hold office, let alone run for another. This idea that they were oblivious is something that's really been shattered as well. Biden's campaign became Harris's campaign due to the timeline, and those folks went on Pod Save America, which is a podcast I don't recommend, but it's hosted by all the old Obama staffers. It was really interesting on that podcast because they said two things that shoot holes in this oblivious argument. One is they said their own internal data showed Biden giving up 400 electoral votes to Donald Trump, which means this whole time they were telling us Biden can win and Biden's a good candidate. Their own internal data said the opposite. And then secondarily, they pointed out in that interview, that their internal data never had Harris leading Trump. So they also knew in that campaign that they weren't going to win while they're taking money from people who rightly are afraid, people in the trans community, folks who want legal access to abortion, folks who are afraid of deportations, these vulnerable communities. They're taking money from them, and we find out they're giving it to like the Oprahs of the world and her staff and things like that. To me, it was just a total bilk. And what is the final cherry on top, in my opinion, you brought up Bernie, is I can go through upteen examples, and we've written books about it, of the marginalization of Bernie Sanders' campaign and Bernie Sanders' style politics. And then when Harris loses, all the very people who helped marginalize him in media have flipped and are all of a sudden acting like Bernie bros. You got James Carville saying, oh, maybe Bernie was right. And David Brooks is like, well, Bernie's got a point. And Joanne Reed and Jason Johnson, that's the guy who called all the women of color who supported Bernie misfit girls from Black Island or something like that. They're now saying, like, yeah, the public doesn't understand. Like, we, you know, reform isn't going to help. You know, we need universal health care. And it's like, you are the exact people who are fighting against the Bernie campaign, and you're on the record doing it. And now these people are saying, well, maybe Bernie was right. Of course, it's 10 years later. There's been way more suffering in this country for people, especially economically. But now the media just acts like no big deal, move on. You know, they never have any accountability for their part in that outcome.
Nolan, you and I wrote in United States of Distraction, which was interesting. It wasn't a book about Trump. It was published in 2019, City Lights. And we carefully argued that despite that Trump was very centric, the media just couldn't turn away from him. During the 2016 campaign, he got double the free coverage that even Hillary Clinton got. Trump strategically partnered with right elements. He harnessed white anxiety through far-right online platforms. He continued to do that this time, except instead of just going to the right, he went on a lot of other podcasts. Yeah, some of them are conservative podcasts, but he really went into that space, whereas the Democrats just really didn't think it was necessary or important to get involved in. I'm reticent to call it the new media because it just isn't in technically so many ways. But that space where so many people are, Democrats decided they weren't going to go, hence ceding that territory for Trump to talk about political aggrandizement and social intolerance, use aggressive rhetoric and posturing, celebrating violence, threatening immigrants, manufacturing all kinds of threats that went completely unchallenged. What might you have to say about the whole strategy regarding media? And now, then we'll go back to where we are now with now all of these social media groups and even the corporate media, they're now kowtowing to Trump.
That's a really great point. It was an untapped resource that broad left in this country really wasn't using in terms of electoral politics. There's a few people like Ro Khanna. Ro Khanna will go on podcasts and things like that. But for the most part, a lot of these elected officials from the Democratic Party try and avoid that space. Bernie is probably one of the most frequent users of the space, AOC, but the rest really don't go on there. And it's a missed opportunity because this is where people are at. And Trump knows he can go in there. And that's why when the media laughed at him for like working at McDonald's or the trash thing or the stupid jokes with Theo Vaughn or the ridiculous conversations with Joe Rogan, I knew the media was wrong. This is where people are. He's reaching millions of people while you guys are talking about whatever you're talking about on CNN to like 300,000 people that night. It also speaks to a bigger problem. This is a problem that goes back to Hillary Clinton and it goes through Joe Biden and it goes through Harris. The Democratic Party consistently, with its media system and establishment, tries to shove candidates down the voters' throats that come from this corporate HR conveyor belt, where they only say the exact right thing. It's inauthentic, it's scripted. That doesn't work in podcasting. Podcasters will blow through that in no time. You got to be able to talk sometimes 1, 2, 3 hours, take any question, have some authenticity, be engaging, know different things, be aware of pop culture. And Democrats simply just aren't spitting out those people. They're spitting out like these basically AI-generated automatons who say whatever it is the establishment wants them to say.
Who now, I guess, we'll be dealing with on platforms like Facebook and others that have now announced that they're going to be launching thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of bots of AI fake characters and so on. That'll give an entire new dimension to fake news and information dissemination, which we'll talk about later in the program. But I just wanted to at least wrap up with some of the electoral business, and sort of segue us into more conversation after the break on media. And that is that what we wrote about before United States was a distraction was that American political culture was becoming more and more centric regarding spectacle. And Trump, coming through The Apprentice and this sort of this con man grifter celebrity character, you know, with this authoritarian personality, you know, he really co-opted so many different threads in American pop culture. And we wrote about this. We said, this isn't really about Trump. It's about the role that the media has played in refashioning political culture, the bread and circus culture, where the media got sucked into the three ring affair and really was like part of the discussion or part of the dialogue or made itself part of the problem by rather than staying out and doing ethical journalism, asking tough questions, covering these issues, they really inserted themselves in the ring worldwide wrestling style as though they were going to take on Trump. And this obviously has backfired wildly.
Absolutely. You know, it's an interesting thing. This isn't at all advocacy for Donald Trump. I'm not saying that the media is victimizing him or something like that. But I do think that Trump has consistently shown that key things he talks about a lot, like immigration, right? We saw the big explosion over immigration amongst the Republican Party over this H-1 visa issue, where a lot of Trump supporters want absolutely no immigrants. Some of Trump's big donors want these visas because it's a way to get immigrant labor in. That is a way the media could ask critical questions to really bring some heat on Donald Trump, to really hold him accountable to his supporters. But instead, they go for these ridiculous, sensationalistic stories. When he gave that rally, the news media, all they're talking about, same things Trump said. It just didn't make sense. Trump's talking about this thing with Greenland. Greenland is a distraction. That's what Trump does. He distracts these sensationalistic topics. The immigration one, that's the one that freaks Trump out. You can see how Elon is scared right now on his platform. He's trying to distract from a discussion of immigration because he's alienated these MAGA supporters. But the media always takes the bait. They'll go for the Greenland story. They won't go for that like immigration division in any serious way. And if they're doing it, they'll do it now because it's become a spectacle because it's got famous people like Elon involved and Vivek and Trump. But they should have been asking those questions for the last year. That's what their job is.
Well, as we've seen, Nolan Higdon, we see those questions, we see those angles often more in the independent media and the independent press rather than the legacy press. So it seems like that there's going to be a lot of work to do reforming whatever passes for so-called mainstream media in this country. Trust in media has now dipped below that of Congress, which is really striking. It's saying something pretty extraordinary. I would like, however, to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with media scholar Nolan Higdon, author of numerous books, including The Anatomy of Fake News, and most recently, author with Allison Butler of Surveillance Education, Navigating the Conspicuous Absence of Privacy in Schools. We'll continue talking about incoming Trump administration and media after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today in this segment, we welcome back media scholar Nolan Higdon, author, lecturer at Merrill College in the Education Department of University of California, Santa Cruz, Project Censored National Judge, author and co-author of numerous books, and a regular commentator, not just with us here on the Project Censored Show, but even in the Devil's Den, in corporate media and at large. Nolan will go and talk to whomever would like to hear critical media literacy applied to current events, to media and politics. And of course, that's what we do here all the time at the Project Censored Show. So, Nolan, we're delighted to have you here again. And let's get to some more contemporary things. I just want to point out to our listeners, we're talking on Wednesday, January 8th. The program airs the following week, just so people have sort of a calendar marker. You mentioned before the break the division between big tech and Musk and the anti-immigrant sentiment in the Republican Party. But let's focus on another element of Musk and how some of the influence, obviously here with the visas, but also influence in terms of the whole social media realm, where Musk pretended to be this champion of free speech while he simultaneously censors and deplatforms so many people. It's even been discovered that he has fake profiles himself. He props himself up with himself through other accounts. But we just recently saw Mark Zuckerberg at Meta that spent years developing this Byzantine, unaccountable fact-checking faction of Meta and Facebook and Instagram and so on, all just to say suddenly that now all of a sudden that Trump is coming in with Musk on his coattails, that Facebook suddenly is not going to do fact checking anymore. When we talk about fact checking, what are we talking about? The Atlantic Council, the PR wing of NATO. Honestly, from some level, I'm glad we might not have to worry about Atlantic Council doing so-called fact checking at Facebook. But let's talk more about this. What's all the liberal hand-wringing about right now around the going to be absence of this so-called fact checking at Meta? And what were some problems with it in the first place?
The whole fact-checking thing to me was always a fool's errand. And I think he'll probably never admit it, but I think he's always got the impression from Zuckerberg, from his interviews and reading his stuff, that he always knew it was a fool's errand too. I think he was pressured by elements of the Democratic Party, especially when they were taking control in 2020, to give the appearance of fact-checking and basically remove any content that would get him in hot water politically. Now, some of this stuff is easy, like child pornography. I don't think it's that controversial to remove off the webpage. But then when he got into like these vague or interpretive or subjective terms of like racism or sexism, things like that, I think he would succumb to the pressure, including removing Trump. But now Trump's back in office. The power structure has changed, and so Zuckerberg changes with it. And this is what I mean about the lack of principles or backbone. He never believed in the fact check. He never believed in it, but he sold it because it kept people on the platform. And these new policies that he's implementing, they do echo Elon Musk in terms of Zuckerberg asserted that he's for free speech, and even if he's fact-checking 1% of true content accidentally gets called false, that's too much. I happen to agree with him on that. I also happen to agree with Elon that I believe in a free speech platform. But the reality is, neither of these platforms, before Elon or whether after Elon took over X, were ever free speech platforms. They're always managed by the algorithm. The algorithm always dictates what content you do and, more importantly, don't see. And I think it's interesting in both these cases, now that Trump's in office, they both say, well, we want to have more positive content and we want to have less politics. So you want to send more feelings of positivity in the Trump era to people, and you want to conceal whatever it is you consider politics. I would argue in a democracy, everything is theoretically political. But that aside, they're going to put this political content away. That's management of information, just what you were accusing them of doing from the other side during the last 4 years. And so to me, this is just a continuation of this oligarchy power over our information structures. And I think the public continuously is making the wrong mistake in a democracy. They're trying to look for the right billionaire to bail them out. Well, this billionaire needs to buy this platform. This billionaire needs to run for office. This billionaire will donate to Harris. Enough with the billionaires. The billionaires are not the solution to your problems. Democracy is. You need to use that power.
Nolan, you just mentioned oligarchs, the sort of racing to find out which are the right oligarchs. Which ones should those be? Speaking of oligarchs, Jeff Bezos over at the Washington Post. Recently, there was an issue of censorship at the Washington Post with a Pulitzer Prize winning cartoonist who resigned from the Post after the paper refused to publish a cartoon in which Bezos was seen as one of several other billionaire oligarchs, including Musk. Bowing at the statue of Donald Trump with bags of gold or money, including a fallen down Mickey Mouse representing Disney. It also had the CEO of the LA Times, Patrick Soon-Shiong. Zuckerberg is one of them too. He was one of the people depicted. Sam Altman with OpenAI was another one depicted. Again, a very pointed critique of how these oligarchs are all now lining up, and then the oligarch media that they own is lining up. And one of the very newspapers that is owned by one of the oligarchs bowing at Trump's feet with a bag of money, his minions at the paper say that's a step too far, and we're not going to run that cartoon. Just like we saw both the LA Times and the Washington Post not endorse anybody for president because they don't want to get involved. But now they're all lining up, as you mentioned earlier before the break. Nolan, this is again a gross example, in my view, of censorship, and it's getting called out as such. Let's not forget that it was the Washington Post that said democracy dies in darkness after the 2016 election when the corporate media mea culpa because they said they failed to critically cover the 2016 campaign. Well, here we are again, rinse and repeat. Nolan Higdon, what do you make of this?
I find it so fascinating that 8 years ago, there was so much emphasis on why we need to protect the free press and we need to protect journalists. I was attacked consistently for using the phrase fake news, even though I was just looking at the history of it. I was attacking any journalists for being fake news. But here you go. This is a perfect example where the press needs to actually be protected. What happened at the Washington Post, but it's silence. There's a din of silence, which makes me question how committed were people actually to free press principles, or did they just see it as a good weapon against their enemy at that time, which was Donald Trump? And then Bezos is a part of that too. Bezos and his paper were very critical of Trump. Now Trump takes power and they flip on a dime. Bezos probably had a sense and a feeling that Trump was going to win, and he wanted those lucrative contracts that he continues to get from the government. And he knew that, last time it brought him all kinds of trouble when Trump took office. So this time he hedged his bets, and he was right. He got in terms economically, and his paper goes with it. I'm not surprised. Again, it's another example, as you point out, of censorship in this country, which unfortunately a lot of people deny happens. And it's also an example of why we cannot allow the oligarchs in this country to consolidate control over the flow of information.
Washington Post's editorial page editor David Shipley claimed that he just disagreed with the artist's interpretation of what exactly happened that led to her resignation. He claimed that there was already a column on the same topic and they were trying to avoid repetition. I mean, is this person who's running the editorial page that politically tone deaf or politically unaware of what's happening with the oligarchic media, with the fact that the public finds that the establishment press it now has a lower trust rating and approval rating than that of Congress, below 17%. This is kind of riveting. Yet somehow we entrust these people to know what the American people want to hear, read, and see. Let's not forget that that stunt by Bezos to prevent any kind of endorsement at the paper for the first time in a long, 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 long time led to over 300,000 people canceling their subscriptions to that paper. This is further looking at the crisis in confidence of the press. And even if you want to give Shipley the benefit of the doubt, as a business decision, this is incredibly foolish at a time like now.
But it's also just hypocritical. This is a paper that ran 16 articles on Bernie Sanders in 16 hours, and 15 of them were negative. Now you don't want to be redundant? I personally don't buy the excuse. I also think if that was the reason, I think the cartoonist would have been informed of it.
It just goes to show that these people are pretty out of touch. And this is, again, what you were saying earlier. One of the things that Trump did, whether you like it or not, is he went onto platforms and went into places where it at least appeared, let's really be specific, it created the impression that he was in touch. Yet, for someone of his ilk, I can think of few people who are more out of touch with what it means to be a regular, ordinary person living in America in the 21st century with the great challenges that people face. Even James Carville in the Democratic Party said, look, the Democrats forgot what I told them in 1992. It's the economy, stupid. And the Democrats just keep saying over and over how great it is. But it doesn't matter how theoretically great or numerically great it looks if rank and file Americans aren't seeing it.
That's this disconnect. You're absolutely right. I do not mean to insinuate anyway that Trump actually has a connection to working people. He does have an amazing way to read the room. And the reason why he's able to do that, I think, or in part, is because he actually goes into the room. When Trump visited that Association of Black Journalists, he had to know that he was in the firing line, but Trump took it. He handled it. He thought it was important to go into those rooms. Democrats typically either don't think they can handle it or don't think they need to, but ultimately what it signals is they seem out of touch. Where ironically, Trump, the billionaire, seems more in touch in those spaces. And I think that's the ground Democrats keep seeding. And it comes from this kind of elitist perspective. Folks will remember Chuck Schumer about 8 years ago said it's okay to lose these working class voters because every voter we lose in that rural area will pick up two more in the suburbs. One, that's totally anti-working class and goes against Carville's it's the economy stupid. But two, that didn't even turn out to be true.
Just recently, we saw in the new coronation of Trump, Kamala Harris took a swipe actually at Sanders, saying that he was supposed to, quote, stand right here, although that is not your nature to just stand where you're told to stand, but just give it a try. That was what she said. He actually sent back and basically he was saying something to the effect that, he's surprised that she even bothered to remember that he was a leading candidate in the primary, beating everybody else at the polls.
Bernie is that figure the neoliberals have desperately tried to get out of the party. They want to shake that New Deal, Great Society type politics. And they see Bernie as kind of this anachronistic figure. And it drives them nuts that he continues to be popular. Even while their candidate, Joe Biden, has taken flak for being old. No one's going after Bernie for being old. Bernie had a heart attack. I'm laughing because that's how popular Bernie is as compared to their candidate. And they try to do what they do best, which is virtue signal. So Harris will sign on to a bill with Sanders, and then she pulls her name from it so she can hold up the bill and signal to progressives. Remember, Hillary Clinton said, I'm a progressive who can get things done. and she wasn't getting much done after 2016. I'm not surprised there's that antagonistic relationship between Bernie and the party, but I am surprised that they're not savvy enough as a party to try to tap into Bernie. I mean, nominate him for a labor position or create a Bernie Sanders bill you say you're going to pass, anything. They just want the guy a race.
The Democratic Party's been doing this for a long time, and certainly the Clintons are the ones that really helped steer the party into the neoliberal right center, where it just continues to go, where we saw Harris campaigning more with Liz Cheney and snubbing Teamsters people and so forth. I mean, it was just preposterous to see the errors writ large taking place. Nolan Higdon, last minute left here. Tell folks, where can they follow your work, find your work? And maybe give us a little bit of a hint of some things that you have in store here as the Trump administration will be sworn back in later this month.
NolanHigdon.substack.com. It's a free newsletter I send out and goes right to your email. And it's got media literacy stuff, media analysis, try to highlight the work of others as well. I'm looking forward to continuing to watch these kind of internal media debates of MAGA and the Trump inauguration. And I'm really interested where social media is going in this era. With the TikTok ban, we've now normalized governments being able to censor platforms. And I'm wondering how that's going to play out in the Trump era. So I'll certainly be keeping an eye on that and talking to the Project Censored Universe.
Nolan Higdon, as ever, thanks for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you.
Coming up next on the Project Censored Show, I will speak with Professor Steve Masick. It'll be deja vu all over again as we look at what's happened to previously underreported stories. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment, we are delighted to bring back longtime team member of Project Censored, Professor Steve Masick. Steve is a professor of communication and media studies at North Central College outside of Chicago and serves as co-coordinator of the project's campus affiliate program. He writes frequently about censorship, First Amendment issues for Truthout, Common Dreams, The Progressive, and many other independent outlets for many, many years. Steve has contributed to Project Censored's top 25 stories and that analysis around those with Andy Lee Roth and now Shaley Voitel. Steve also, for many years now, has spearheaded our Deja Vu chapter, which takes a look at what's happened to previously underreported stories. And this year, in Project Censored State of the Free Press 2025, in Chapter 2, along with Nicole Mendez Villarrubia, Grace Hardy, and Olivia Rosenberg, Steve writes, each year, Project Censored's top 25 story list identifies and publicizes socially and politically significant independently produced news stories that have gone underreported by major corporate news organizations. So, Steve Masick, first of all, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Mickey. It's always a pleasure.
You had a new book come out last year on censorship around the world that you edited with Nolan Higdon and Robin Anderson. You're a prolific person when it comes to cataloging all things news media censorship, highlighting the work that independent media do. Why do we do the deja vu chapter, Steve? Why is this analysis significant when it comes to things like media literacy?
It's important for, I think, a couple of reasons, especially for people who want to be media literate. But I think for me, the main reason it's important is it's historical memory that runs counter to the erasure of the past and the whitewashing and revision of the past that so often happens in the corporate media. So often the corporate media rewrite history. And by looking back at stories that the project has identified as underreported in the past, you have this shock of recognition that some of the issues we're coping with today have happened in the past, and that the corporate media never really provide that context when they're covering these sorts of issues. That's one reason. Second is that sometimes these stories do make their way into public discourse. After independent media, alternative media have identified important issues, they sometimes do, after the fact, get picked up by the larger establishment press. But what's interesting, I think, is that oftentimes when the establishment press does pay attention to these stories that have been neglected and ignored, they do so in a very selective way. They leave out important details, important bits of context that were included in the independent coverage of those stories. So this is why we revisit stories from previous year's top 25 censored stories list, because we want to track whether or not they are making their way into the public discourse, whether or not they're getting finally the attention they deserve. And then oftentimes as well, there are developments related to the story, factual developments related to the story, or political or social developments that are related to the story that are important for our readers to know.
This is a way to incorporate the context of history, why it matters, why it's important in the present, and it helps us frame and understand the present and also maybe better navigate the future. You know, as Gore Vidal said, we live in the United States of amnesia. Corporate media don't always really cover a lot of these things. And of course, we laud them when they pick up, like you suggested. One of the first stories, Steve, we're going to talk about that you wrote about is the repression of Palestinian media. That's from State of the Free Press 2023. That was a number 14 story, a top story from a couple years ago. One of the things we mentioned, Andy Roth and I, in the intro this year for the Izzy Awards, one of the recipients this past year was a Palestinian journalist. It was Mohammed El Kurd, who was the first Palestinian correspondent to work for The Nation in its 160-year history. And he was honored for reports on Western journalists have Palestinian blood on their hands and the right to speak for ourselves. So adding these kinds of particular perspectives, Lord knows, when you look at places like the New York Times, their Palestinian voices are almost never heard
Right,
directly or
right,
never
right.
quoted directly. And so, this issue, what has been happening since not just October 7, 2023, what's been happening going back decades in the region and to Palestinians is that the Western press has either turned a blind eye or has looked through a very distorted or biased frame. And one of the results of that is that many people in the United States and in parts of the West, not only might they not want to know some of the things that are happening, they're not really given adequate opportunities to know what's happening. And people like El Kurd say, look, this does mean that we have a responsibility to learn more and understand. And Steve, one of these stories here that you're going to talk about, this was published in The Intercept, published in Middle East Eye, Jordan Times. So let's talk about the repression of Palestinian media, Steve Masick.
The story that was identified as the number 14 story on the State of the Free Press 2023 concerned various ways that prior even to October 7, 2023, Palestinian media was being repressed. One of the obvious ways that they're being repressed is that Israeli soldiers, the IDF, were arresting Palestinian journalists, sometimes killing Palestinian journalists who were simply doing their jobs. Reporting on usually Israeli repression of Palestinian protesters. But that wasn't the extent of it. It also concerned the fact that Israel, through this branch of the Israeli intelligence, was putting pressure on social media platforms to either block content by Palestinians and by Palestinian journalists attempting to report on what was really happening, or they were graylisting or shadow banning that content. So they allowed it to be posted, but it wasn't visible to users. And the other thing that was happening that we flagged here is that Israeli security people were using Palestinian journalists' own social media posts as evidence against them when they would detain them and try them for various sorts of crime. So this initial story looked at all of the different ways that Israel was repressing Palestinian journalists, from outright murdering journalists to putting pressure on big tech commercial social media platforms to engage in what I know you have called censorship by proxy, to act in the interest of the Israeli government by banning posts by Palestinians. One of the things that was discovered by these journalists who reported the original story is that even mentioning Zionism was considered to be hate speech by Facebook And so they would routinely block any kind of post that mentioned Zionism in any sort of critical context. So the update is that more Palestinian journalists have been murdered in this conflict than any war for at least the past 100 years. And there is a lot of evidence gathered by Palestinian journalists that a significant number of those deaths of Palestinian journalists were deliberate, that the Israelis were deliberately targeting. It's a tragedy that 200 journalists have lost their lives covering the war in Gaza. But beyond that, it seems like, according to evidence that's been gathered by the Palestinian Syndicate of Journalists, that a significant portion of those deaths were actually murders, that Palestinian journalists were being deliberately targeted. And that's plausible because of what we know Israel did to Al Jazeera. They shut down the offices of Al Jazeera, which is a, well-respected international news network based in the Middle East, and confiscated equipment, banned them in the parliament, cut off their access to Gaza and to other places. Given how little respect Israel has had for the freedom of the press, it's not implausible that they would be deliberately targeting other Palestinian journalists. It is a breathtaking, atrocious body count that, by everybody's admission, includes a majority of civilians. As we note in the update, from time to time, establishment news outlets like the Washington Post or the New York Times will acknowledge the sheer number of journalists who've been killed, or will acknowledge the social media censorship of Palestinian voices, but it's always in passing. It's never a kind of detailed examination. So one of the other things that's happened since October 7, 2023, is that the level of and the rate of repression of Palestinian voices online has skyrocketed. Global Voices, which is a very mainstream media rights and media advocacy organization that focuses on digital media around the globe and censorship of digital media around the globe, has actually said that what's happened to Palestinian voices online since October 7, 2023 constitutes digital apartheid. And this Palestinian-based digital rights group, 7AMLE, noted that they have received 1,400 reports of unjustified content moderation between October 7, 2023 and November 27, 2023. So just in the month after October 7th, there were 1,400 requests that came from Israel's cyber unit. And that compares with just 1,100 for the entire previous year. So there's been this dramatic escalation and increase in the repression of Palestinian and pro-Palestinian content on these platforms. Many of my colleagues have found that if they try to post a Palestinian flag, they try to post a news story about what's happening in Gaza, an independent news story about what's happening in Gaza on Instagram or Facebook or any number of other social media platforms, they find that it is rendered invisible. It happened to me not too long ago, where people said, "I can no longer see your post," which had to do with Israel being charged with crime and Netanyahu being charged with crimes against humanity. And still there, nobody can see it. And one of the ways you can tell that things are being shadow banned is if you normally make posts that get, say, 20 or 30 engagements from people, and all of a sudden it drops to zero or one, there's a chance that it has been shadow banned.
I need to remind our listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacific Radio. My guest right now is the esteemed Professor Steve Masick from North Central College outside of Chicago. We're talking about deja vu, previously censored stories. Where are they now? We will continue that conversation after this brief musical break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today in this segment, we are speaking with Professor Steve Masick at North Central College. He is a longtime contributor to Project Censored's Top 25 research, and of course, also for many years has led a team of colleagues and students and researchers looking at what's happened to previously underreported stories, tracking them, seeing have they been picked up by the establishment press or do they languish in obscurity. And Steve, before the break, we were talking about a significant one that's unfortunately still all too relevant, and that's the suppression or repression of Palestinian media. We were talking about the deaths of Palestinian journalists. We mentioned several examples. Well, that's certainly a canary in the coal mine for global press freedom. And that leads me to one of the other stories. Speaking of canaries, a different kind of canary. This is the Canary Mission. Canary Mission blacklists. Canary Mission is an organization you're going to talk about. I just talked with ethnic studies scholar Omar Zaza from San Francisco State University, doing a book on censored press. Terms of Servitude is the title of his book, looking at the ways in which we had things like digital apartheid, the way the US and the Israeli state used technology to suppress the Palestinian people. One of the components of this, Steve, is of course surveillance. And the blacklisting based on this surveillance of pro-Palestinian activists chills free speech rights. And so you have another story here from The Intercept from 2020, from The Nation from 2021. This goes back a number of years, but the Canary Mission is still around. So what's the threat of this now, Steve, in this context?
This story was the number six story on the State of the Free Press 2022 list of top underreported stories of the year. The story itself, as you say, is based on two stories, one in The Intercept and one in The Nation. These reports by independent media detailed the activities of this McCarthyite group, Canary Mission, who routinely publish reports about activists, scholars and students, most of whom are critical of Israel and involved in pro-Palestinian activism, as terrorists and anti-Semites. And what Canary Mission does is not just mention these people and smear them as terrorists and anti-Semites, but they deliberately try to get the targets of their smear campaigns expelled from school. If they've just recently graduated, they deliberately try to undermine their employment opportunities by contacting prospective employers. They publicize their names and defame them as anti-Semites. And what business is going to want to hire somebody who's been identified openly as an anti-Semite? So at the time that we first covered this, there was very little coverage in the corporate press of Canary Mission. If they're mentioned at all, they were mentioned only in passing. There was never any kind of investigation about who was funding Canary Mission, who might be directing their activities, and so on. Since this story was first flagged by Project Censored, there has been some fairly decent independent media coverage of Canary Mission. In December 2023, The Nation published a comprehensive article by James Bamford about Canary Mission, and he also appeared on Democracy Now! To talk about how Canary Mission was going after and attempting to smear pro-Palestinian activists or, critics of Israel. And a number of student newspapers have actually reported fairly heavily on this because a lot of Canary Mission's activity is focused on trying to smear student activists and professors, which is a deliberate attempt to chill dissent about the U.S. support for Israel's war in Gaza. So what is very interesting is that Bamford and some of the other student media have started drawing attention. Who is supporting Canary Mission? So Bamford himself relied on a report by The Forward, which is a progressive Jewish publication, longstanding Jewish newspaper, that dug into where Canary Mission gets their funding. And it turns out that Canary Mission is getting a lot of funding from some big Jewish foundations like the Helen Diller Family Foundation, the Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco, the Jewish Community Foundation of Los Angeles, who were funneling their donations to Canary Mission through an Israeli nonprofit called Megamot Shalom. And Bamford raised the question of whether or not this might be illegal, and that Canary Mission, the people who were funding Canary Mission, were potentially committing a crime acting as agents of a foreign power. Also, the way that the funding, as Bamford pointed out in his Nation article, the way that the funding of Canary Mission operated, it made clear that there's some good reasons to believe the charges that have long been leveled at Canary Mission, that they operate at the direction of Israeli intelligence, that they are a project of Israeli intelligence operating in the U.S., targeting, in most cases, U.S. citizens. It's incredibly alarming. And what's interesting is that there has been, aside from an article in The Guardian, which is actually, I would consider to be also a form of independent media because it's run by a not-for-profit, there has been very little coverage of this in the corporate press.
And Steve Masick, for all the hullabaloo we hear about Putin and Russia interfering and trying to sow dissent and discord and so on, I mean, here's example after example of the Israeli government or the IDF or Israeli intelligence or others nearly being caught red-handed.
It's not proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's nevertheless suggestive.
More suggestive than Russia.
Right. The fact is that the corporate media are very selective in their outrage about foreign attempts to influence American politics. They cry to the high heavens about Russia. Of course, we're all familiar with what's happening at the Supreme Court and the debate about whether or not this law that Biden signed is going to be allowed to shut down TikTok because it's supposedly an instrument of Chinese influence in the U.S. But there's very little outcry about Israel's influence over American politics. There's very little outcry over Saudi Arabia's influence over American politics. Saudi Arabia spends more on lobbying than just about any country in. And I actually wrote about this for a dispatch that went out, a Project Censor dispatch, a couple of months ago. There's just very little attention to all of the efforts of these deep-pocketed foreign governments who happen to be classified as our allies over our political culture and our politics. And in many cases, I think I would say that the kind of influence they exert, like the influence Saudi Arabia and Israel exert over our politics, comes close to breaking our laws.
We can cite the late, great George Carlin to kind of frame this. Let's not have a double standard here. One standard will do just fine. Steve, we only have a couple minutes left in this segment, and I know there are several other stories in the book, and we're not going to have time to get into them. One is on femicide and the global war of violence against women. The other one, however, which is also just very relevant, is Ukrainian fascist trained U.S. white supremacists. That's another story. I mean, do you want to talk briefly about one of these?
This story about Ukrainian fascists training U.S. white supremacists. This was a story that we, Project Censored, drew attention to back in 2018. It's about the fact that organized far-right white supremacists in the U.S. were traveling to Ukraine to be trained by members of the right-wing Azov Battalion, which was a kind of right-wing paramilitary group in Ukraine that rose up after Ukraine's independence, that has openly celebrated Nazi figures, people who had collaborated with the Nazis in Ukraine, so on, have explicitly anti-Semitic and racist ideology, and had a huge influence in the Ukrainian government back in 2018, and was actually officially incorporated. The Azov Battalion, this paramilitary group, was officially incorporated into Ukrainian military. U.S. white supremacists were going over there and training and then coming back with this very sophisticated knowledge of weaponry and warfare to the United States, which is terrifying. We flagged this based on some stories by Mint Press News back in 2018. Since that time, of course, there's been a big change, which is Russia invaded Ukraine. It sparked this massive conflagration that has killed hundreds of thousands of people, displaced 10 million Ukrainians. And what's really interesting here, and this is something that Jacobin and other independent news media have drawn attention to since we first flagged this story, is that now that the US is funneling all sorts of military aid to Ukraine, we've memory-holed the Nazi connections to the Azov Battalion, and there's been an effort retroactively to whitewash This group, which had been was responsible for training US white supremacists. Interestingly, there still is a flow of white supremacists who are going over to volunteer to fight against Russia for Ukraine, but we are not seeing any coverage of this in the establishment commercial press.
And just like when we were talking about critiquing the Israeli government and their policies and their actions doesn't make us anti-Semitic, talking about what's happening in Ukraine and Azov Battalion doesn't make anybody pro-Putin.
You could even make the argument some people have that the Azov Battalion played this really important role right after the invasion, the Russian invasion. They were the ones who defended Mariupol. There was no one else to resist the Russian incursion. But nevertheless, you have to look at their really unsavory associations, the leaders' unsavory past statements, and there's lots of reasons to doubt that they are this reformed and rehabilitated organization. The communication director for Azov still has a Twitter account that is full of swastikas and neo-Nazi symbols. It raises all sorts of questions about just how reformed they are. But the degree to which the mainstream corporate media has been covering them, they've talked about them as sort of rehabilitated or reformed, that they've distanced themselves from their far-right racist past. I don't believe that that's the case, and a lot of independent reporting seems to suggest that it isn't true.
Well, Steve Masick, unfortunately, we are out of time, even though we could go on, and we've been filling books like this for years, and you've been doing chapters on Deja Vu with us for years on these unreported stories. It's a very important exercise in understanding historical context and the present and how censorship continues to work and function in our society. And obviously, because of the topics we talked about today, it will probably be shadow banned and
Absolutely.
people.
I'm not, I mean, I'm expecting that any of my social media followers will be able to hear this show.
We'll test that theory next week, Steve.
All
So,
right.
at any rate, Steve Masick, professor of communications at North Central College outside of Chicago, longtime contributor to Project Censored. We've been talking about his contributions to State of the Free Press 2025 on Deja Vu, what's happened to previously unreported stories. Steve Masick's most recent book is Censorship, Digital Media, and the Global Crackdown on Freedom of Expression, edited by Steve Masick, Robin Anderson, Nolan Higdon. Steve Masick, as ever, it's great to catch up with you. Thank you so much for your time and for your
Yo,
erudite
thank
analysis.
you so much.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm Mickey Huff, the executive producer and host of the program. Anthony Fest is our longtime senior producer. The Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work at projectcensored.org. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous.